From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why big business needs to give dollars to Detroit.
Detroit means something around the country and around the world, and it's closely identified with Michigan.
A Michigan writer tackles the explosive issue of teachers and students becoming intimately involved.
Until my sort of antenna were up for this kind of story, I hadn't noticed it quite so often as I have since.
And this weekend's Movement Festival gets us talking about techno and Detroit.
We had the option of being creative because of the musical history that's here. Jazz is here. Motown is here. Funk, soul, rock is here.
And we look at what's turning into a record-breaking year for auto recalls. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. General Motors announced today it is recalling another 2.4 million vehicles in the U.S. That brings the number of vehicles GM's recalled this year to 13.6 million, a new record for the automaker. But it's not just GM to recall millions of vehicles. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we look at the entire auto industry and ask, have auto recalls become the new normal? Then a Michigan author writes about a love story between a 17-year-old high school student and her nearly 30-year-old calculus teacher. The book was inspired by a true story from Grand Rapids. That's later this hour. But first, a state house committee is expected to vote this week on the state's proposed contribution to the grand bargain. That's the agreement to soften the blow to city pensioners while protecting city-owned work at the Detroit Institute of Arts. The $816 million grand bargain would include money from foundations, both local and national, from the state and the DIA. But Detroit Free Press business columnist Tom Walsh believes it's time for another face at the grand bargain table, business. Tom, your recent column says, and I quote, "The business sector must ante up to get Detroit out of bankruptcy fast." Why?
Well, I think everybody else has almost, and the other major players, the philanthropic foundations are in. The governor is pledged that the state will get there too. Obviously, the House and Senate still have to agree to that, but the private sector has been part and parcel of this entire effort to kind of get Detroit back on track. They've given the city police cars and EMS vehicles and done other things as well. And now they're being asked to be part of the $100 million that the DIA itself has pledged to be part of the grand bargain. And so the auto companies have been asked along with some of the other usual suspects.
And who are some of those other usual suspects?
Well, you got Dan Gilbert. They've confirmed that Quicken Loans has been asked and are considering. I don't think it's much question that they will participate. It's sort of how much will they, what level will they participate at? Roger Penske, Blue Cross CEO Dan Lepp, told me that that he's been asked and they're considering as well. DTE Energy, the companies with big investments in the city in one way or the other.
So this would their money would go toward helping the DIA make that $100 million share of the grand bargain then?
Exactly. And the DIA they've actually got some other foundations involved too that have not been part of the grand bargain to date. The Getty Foundation out of California is said to be considering it or has acknowledged that they're considering it. We don't know if they're in for sure or for how much.
Now, we've got companies like GM and Ford and Chrysler and Blue Cross and some of those other businesses are really important sources of donations to a lot of worthy charities and organizations. So would we have to accept that those groups might be hurt in order to help Detroit?
Well, I think that over time, yes. I think that there's ever since the Great Recession of 08-09, the spending or the amount available for philanthropic spending by the auto companies and the suppliers who used to lead the way. It was sort of a time-honored way that every philanthropic group in town sort of got their money. They'd agree, you know, which auto company would provide the chairman for this year's event, and GM would take the lead on this, Ford would take the lead on that, and then each of the three auto companies would say, okay, here's what we're in for. And once they knew that, they'd go down and start to talk to the suppliers and some of the big auto dealer groups in town, those, you know, would be the usual, you know, donors to these kinds of things, along with the other big corporate citizens, everything from, you know, Quicken and to the Illiches to Penske and Blue Cross, mm-hmm. utilities, those kinds of folks.
You know, it is interesting. Every time a piece like yours or similar pieces talking about momentum toward the grand bargain is in the paper, when you read the reader comments, which I do, there's still a real strong feeling. In fact, it was reflected in an op-ed piece in this past Sunday's Free Press, of people who still say, hey, Detroit fouled its own nest, let it figure its way out. And they say, hey, this is just drum beating, you know, the media trying to lead the parade toward the grand bargain. How is this not drum beating?
Well, you know, I think the media has a role. We have a role in trying to shed light on a subject that often creates more heat. You know, this is a region that's been plagued by fault lines around, you know, race and city suburb problems for a long, long time, and there's a lot of that kind of knee-jerk reaction about history. And, you know, we did a big project, boy, almost, you know, going on a year ago now, called How Detroit Went Broke, that, you know, that won a lot of national acclaim, that really went through what really did happen. You know, it's not a simple story. It's not, well, it was Coleman Young's fault, or it was GM's fault for, you know, moving stuff out of Detroit, or Chrysler's fault for going from Highland Park to Auburn Hills. None of those is a simple answer, but there's a little bit of, you know, truth to all of it. And what we need to understand is we can't go back. It took a long time to get here. We do have some momentum. This is a chance to get the balance sheet cleaned up and get kind of a fresh start financially, you know, in a very similar way to what happened with the auto companies. There are obviously differences between municipal and corporate bankruptcies, but it did work for the autos. It did give them, you know, a base again from which to build. And I think Detroit has new leadership. It deserves a chance to see what they can do. And you know, the judges have been working pretty hard at it. And I think all with good intent.
And I think, as you pointed out in your piece, Tom, it Detroit's fate does impact that of the state of Michigan.
Absolutely. If you go around the country, around the world, people in the rest of the world might not be able to tell where Michigan is on a map, but they all know something, or think they know something, about Detroit, whether it's about, you know, the auto industry or about its music. Detroit means something around the country and around the world, and it's closely identified with Michigan.
Well, I want to turn your attention to the late word we have that J.P. Morgan Chase is about to announce that it's going to invest $100 million in Detroit. What are you hearing in terms of where that money would go and what it might be able to do?
It'll be a combination of things. I think it'll be mostly the kinds of things that banks do. It will be loans. There will be loans at hopefully attractive interest rates that will go to everything from blight to job training and mortgage money for home loans, as, you know, as the mayor tries to, you know, get people to bid on houses and get some more action going in the neighborhoods as well as downtown and midtown. So I think they've been discussing with J.P. Morgan Chase and other banks and lenders and financial folks around the country about, okay, Detroit's a place to invest. We have some things going on that are good. We have low cost of property and real estate, and just movement again in the auto industry and some other industries. So I think it'll be a mixture of things. There'll be some grants. There'll be some job training, there'll be some loans, and it's, you know, it's a big name coming to town. Which
a big name with deep pockets.
A big name with deep pockets, and it follows on the heels of Goldman Sachs came to town a few months ago with a program that's more aimed at entrepreneurship and helping startup businesses, 10,000 small businesses. You know, every big national outfit like that has has some community programs, and they, you know, that they've tried in other cities, but they're being encouraged, I think, to look at Detroit, because Detroit has become, you know, kind of a poster child for, you know, industrial decay and erosion. And if with all the attention of the municipal bankruptcy now, I think there are a lot of the big financial firms are looking at it too, and they also, I mean, they, you know, they got beat up pretty good.
They did.
The recession in 08, 09, so they have a little image repair of their own to do, so that's part of this as well.
And I can only imagine that this image of Jamie Dimon coming in with $100 million worth of J.P. Morgan Chase loans and grants just kind of sends a general message to the business world in order, the idea of getting more of these businesses on board, the grand bargain to get this thing across the finish line.
Well, exactly. And, you know, anywhere they can get it from. And they've been working, the governor's been working this for a while. And I think, you know, he's got a credible partner, I think, in Mike Duggan on some of these outreach to the rest of the country. They're both good at talking to bankers in Wall Street. I mean, Duggan had to do this with the DMC, you know, financing all kinds of stuff. And the governor has been to New York, I mean, for the usual bond rating kind of meetings. But I went along on one meeting where he had Bill Ford with him. He had Chris Illich with him. He had Jerry Anderson, the CEO of DTE, with him, where they're just talking to business people about the story in Michigan is changing, and there's a lot of reasons to invest, a lot of reasons to think that there's some momentum that you didn't see a decade ago.
Tom Walsh, Detroit Free Press business columnist. Thanks for talking with us, Tom.
All right, Cindy, take care.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Any romantic relationship between a teacher and a student is a shocking story. And one initial reaction might be, how does this happen? Writer Christina Riggle of Grand Rapids tackled this thorny subject in her latest novel called The Whole Golden World. Christina Riggle, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
So you start this story by taking us right into the courtroom where high school calculus teacher T.J. Hill is on trial for an affair with his 17-year-old student named Morgan Minetti. And right out of the gate, tell us, where does Morgan decide she's going to sit?
Yes, she walks in with her family, but then she turns to the left and sits behind the defendant. She sits behind the teacher in the courtroom.
So this really was inspired by something you saw. Tell us about that.
It was. It was inspired by an article in the Grand Rapids Press about one of these cases. And what really caught my attention was what we just talked about, the fact that the young woman, who in the real case was 18 by the time of the court proceedings, but had been 17 at the time of the incident, she chose to sit behind the defendant. And I thought, because what fascinates me as a novelist is differing points of view and looking at the same facts from different perspectives, I thought that seemed like a natural jumping-off place for me to explore in a book.
Okay. Well, all right. We're going to start by the fact that you then circle back to the start of the school year 9 months prior, and you very carefully take us through how everybody wound up in that courtroom, and you show us the story really through the eyes of three women. So let's start with the student, with Morgan Minetti. Tell us about Morgan.
Yes, Morgan is a precocious young lady. She has an air of maturity. She's one of these young women you would call an old soul. She relates very well to adults and has been given a great deal of responsibility by her mother, in part because her mother is distracted by having a couple of twins who need a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's sort of deputized Morgan. And Morgan finds this in some ways flattering, but she's also just over it because she's given so much responsibility, but not the freedom that goes along with it that she feels she's entitled to. I think a lot of teenagers struggle with this, particularly teenagers who are seem very mature beyond their years.
And it's pretty clear Morgan does not see how smart and beautiful she is. In fact, she's consumed with self-consciousness about a scar that's on her face. Tell us about that scar.
Yeah, she has a scar that's sort of near her jawline, and it's the kind of thing, the way I envision it, that people would not even necessarily notice immediately about her. But this scar just becomes the focus of her attention and her appearance because it's a flaw. And, of course, teenagers do obsess about flaws, don't we all, actually?
Yes, indeed.
In fact, she probably draws more attention to it by she's constantly pulling her hair over it and trying to cake it up with makeup.
I'm speaking with author Christina Riggle of Grand Rapids about her novel, her fifth novel, A Whole Golden World. And The Whole Golden World really takes us into the inner workings of an affair between a high school math teacher and his 17-year-old student. And Morgan's mother, Dinah Minetti. I have to say, as I read Dinah, and I'm the mother of she's now 20, but I've been through the mother of the teenager. And I have to say, I saw myself in that side of Dinah that could kind of never see her kids in the wrong, where you always try to find a reason for why they do something and try to especially kind of stand up for them, maybe taking it a little too far.
Yeah, that's a real struggle for Dinah because her boys in particular she views as underdogs, the twins who have difficulties and challenges. And, you know, she views them as underdogs and you have to fight for kids who have special needs and who need things that maybe other kids don't. But, yeah, I think that makes it hard for her to see her kids clearly, and not just the twins, but but all three of them. You know, it's a tough line to walk for any parent of any child is – where do you defend and where do you not? It's not always clear.
And the third woman in the whole golden world is Rain Hill, who is the wife of the math teacher, of T.J. Hill, who thinks she's just so lucky that T.J. chose her.
Mm-hmm. Rain, I knew she was going to be the toughest character to write by far because I knew that she was going to be loyal, which she is. She just can't believe, first of all, any of the truth of it. And then she's so devoted and so in love with him, which are virtues, and as she sees them, virtues. Mm-hmm. Because she almost sort of has a rather old-fashioned sense that you don't quit on a marriage when times get tough. You know, in that sense, she's a little bit of a throwback. And I knew it was going to be tough to write her character in a way that was believable, but I found her the most interesting character to write, actually.
Yeah, she was a very interesting character to discover. And one thing that is extremely clear all through the novel is her dream of becoming pregnant is all-consuming.
Mm,
and
indeed.
One wonders, is that undermining her marriage to the point where her husband starts looking at an underage student, thinking she's looking good? Did it kind of force him into that?
Well, it certainly doesn't help. I mean, infertility is—it's, you know, Rain sort of sees this as her problem and her pain and her struggle. But of course, it's not just hers.
Sure.
Even if perhaps TJ is not quite as enthusiastic, you can easily see how he would feel like a failure in this very basic masculine job.
Absolutely.
So it certainly does not help their situation.
And you really do get a sense he misses the wife that he had before the infertility issue took over their marriage. And I'm wondering, in your mind, was his wife, did that drive him into the arms of Morgan? I guess I'm asking another way. Is he an all-out villain?
I think that's up for debate. I do think his character, though, shifts as the book goes on without giving away too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think he's necessarily 100% villain. But I wrote him so that it would be interesting to converse on that very subject. I like book clubs tend to gravitate to my books, and I like to write books that create some points of discussion. And I think that's up for debate. No, I did not intend to write him as an out-and-out villain, but opinions on him certainly range from what I hear from readers.
So, Christina, would you read us a bit from The Whole Golden World? And this is the part when Morgan comes to see Mr. Hill after class for the first time because he confiscated her phone during class, a very relatable thing that's happened to many teenagers. So it's the first after-school visit with Morgan and Mr. Hill.
Certainly. Morgan knew she should leave. Her brothers would be getting antsy. Her mom would be wondering why they were late. Yet she said, "Look, it's none of my business, but are you okay?" In the pause, he'd been staring down at the surface of his desk, drumming his fingers. He startled back to life. Huh? Morgan brushed her hair forward on her scar side. You just look like you're not feeling well. I'm stressed out, actually. This calculus stuff is hard. He laughed darkly. Probably not for you, though. Morgan just shrugged. It hadn't been that hard for her so far, but she didn't want to act smarter than him like she was bragging. Mr. Hill continued, I just have to refresh myself on the details, you know? All those years teaching X plus 7 equals 14 in September have rotted my brain. And I'm worried the kids can tell. Can you tell? Is it obvious? She shook her head. Nah, you seem fine to me. This was a lie, Morgan realized as soon as she said it. She'd already thought he looked nervous and unsure, his gaiety in the classroom more forced than she remembered from ninth grade. But he wasn't putting up a front with her for some reason, which Morgan found both weird and thrilling. He shook his head hard then, like a dog shaking off water. Anyway, sorry, you don't want to listen to some old man groan about his job. Morgan laughed. Oh, yeah, old. Get out the wheelchair, Gramps. You can't be more than, what, 30? I'll have you know I'm a mere 29 years old, for another few months anyway. You sure know how to cheer up a person. Thanks, Morgan. He was now smiling so wide she saw his cheek tuck in with a dimple. She'd never seen that before. Morgan felt a tingly wave of heat pouring down over her. Her phone chimed. Her brother's, she knew without looking. Look, I gotta run. My brothers are expecting me. Sorry about the texting. Sure, Morgan, I understand. Happens to the best of us. Morgan had to work hard not to skip out of the room. She turned back just at the doorway and saw him watching her. She turned away and tipped her head, letting her hair fall to hide her smile.
And that's writer Christina Riggle reading an excerpt from her novel, The Whole Golden World. Christina, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Techno music fans from around the world are getting ready for the Movement Electronic Music Festival. It hits downtown Detroit this Memorial Day weekend. This year's festival brings more than 100 artists to the city. Flint's Desi Magby, also known as DJ Psycho, has played a big part in making Michigan a major player in the world's electronic music scene. He got hooked on electronic music as a fifth grader, and he's been making music and DJing for 30 years. All right, Psycho, you grew up in Flint,
yeah.
Right? What hooked you on electronic music, and how old were you?
Oh, well, my uncles were bringing in cassettes and 8-tracks and records and whatnot, and so, like, my first instance was, like, the first Kraftwerk records and J. Michael Jarre with the Oxygen records and so on and so forth. And then 1981 happened. Well, I'm skipping a step because Yellow Magic Orchestra came in 79, and that was the first electronic music record I ever bought. In 1981, the doors blew open because you had Kraftwerk's Computer World, and then you had the two first instances out of Detroit, which was Charivari by a number of names, and Alleys of Your Mind by Cybertron. Those records right there, I mean, we were playing those same records that everybody was playing in Detroit. We were playing in Flint as well, mm-hmm. because whatever happened on Flint, on Detroit radio, we would just adapt to, because either, you know, you'd had somebody that was had their antennas up and wired and so on and so forth, so it was pointing towards Detroit when we would get the electrifying mojo and WGPR and Nat Morris and The Scene and this, that.
It is funny. There was no internet streaming in those days.
No, it wasn't. You had to get it off the radio and have your cassette recorders ready to go, and it was just all the stuff that was interspersed with all the music that I loved in the first place, you know, like all the post-disco stuff, a lot of Prince, a lot of George Clinton, P-Funk. And
here you are. It's 2014, and you've built a career. You are a noted DJ. What does this give you? And How do you turn all of that back to your audiences at the dance clubs?
I use what I do at this point in my career as a point to educate. Now it's way more important right now to be able to display the history and the what it takes to get from point A to point B because of how technology is. And so now I'm at the point where in my life where I have to teach.
What are you teaching?
I am teaching about the love of the music, the history of the music. You know, people don't understand how important something like Flashlight by Parliament from 77 factors into what the music that we make right now. Because if there was none of that stuff, there would have been no Oizo, no Bassline House, none of that.
Another name to watch for at this year's festival is Asher Perkins. This is the first time DJ and producer Asher Perkins will be performing at the Movement Festival in Hart Plaza. And Asher, you grew up, as we discovered when you were on stateside last year, you grew up playing with your family's traditional Irish music band, Finn Vara's Wren. So what led you to Detroit techno and hooked you?
Well, the kind of music that I grew up playing is traditional Irish dance music. So it was always up-tempo. You know, it was always somewhat for a party setting, or even if it was a concert, it was, you know, just really upbeat, uplifting music. So that was what I grew up around. That's what I always loved. And then as a teenager, first I got really into punk rock. And, you know, I begged my parents for an electric guitar. And I did that for a while. And somewhere along the lines, some friends of mine were like, hey, have you heard this techno stuff? You know, check this out. And I always thought techno was like this really cheesy, like intense, I don't know, like just picturing like a parody of a rave scene from a movie or something, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like not interested at all until they started showing me some of this stuff. And it was actually really like alternative and, you know, just different. I'd never heard anything like it. So it just immediately grabbed my attention.
So I want both of you to give us a sense of what it is that the rest of the world sees in Detroit and Michigan's electronic music, because we know people come from all over the world to Movement Festival. What makes Michigan and Detroit music unique and sets it apart, let's say, from British and European techno? I'll let you start, Desi.
It's the struggle. That's what it's all about. It's the struggle. What we do with our music and how we create it is completely different from what everybody else's does because of our perspective.
And it's what, like, kind of struggle? What do you mean the struggle?
Like, okay.
Racial, industrial? It's
racial, industrial, classists, everything. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, techno was supposed to be what it was supposed to represent at the time that it came around, was supposed to represent the sounds of the machines rusting, you know, like mm-hmm. the automotive industry and how it's, you know, the streets are shaped, you know, the structure and so on and so forth. So when all of that stuff left, you had to do something. Either you were going to get into a life of crime, or you were going to leave, or you're going to be creative. And we had the option of being creative because of the musical history that's here. Jazz is here. Motown is here. Funk, soul, rock, garage rock. Mm-hmm. Punk is here. MC5, Marvin Gaye. And there's always this connecting point of soul in all of those musics. All of it. And so that's the difference between what we do and what a whole lot of everybody else is either attempting or tried or completely forgotten about. That's also what makes, to me, what makes Movement special as opposed to every other Northern American festival that has incorporated electronic music.
I definitely agree with Desi regarding the struggle of the city. And what I hear in Detroit techno is not only the hardship, but also a very, very strong sense of hope.
The Movement Festival runs through the three-day Memorial Day weekend at Hart Plaza. You can get all the information and all the schedules on their website, movement.us. Asher Perkins and Desi Magby, a.k.a. DJ Psycho. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
It's been awesome.
Thank you. Still to come, Michigan has now entered its second year as a right-to-work state. What has that meant for one teachers' union? We find out in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If it seems to you like auto recalls are on the rise, well, you're right. It's not just General Motors, who's recalled something like 13 million vehicles this year in the U.S., and that counts today's newly announced four recalls involving more than 2.4 million vehicles. The entire auto industry has recalled about 20 million vehicles this year. That puts the industry well on its way to breaking the recall record of nearly 31 million, and that record has stood for a decade. Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton and NPR's business reporter Sonari Glinton have both been covering their recalls extensively. Sonari, are we seeing more recalls because of the GM ignition switch troubles, or is there more to it?
It's one of those things where this company has learned from the two big recalls in the last 15 years, the Ford rollover crisis and the Toyota recall. And those two recalls are sort of, you know, case studies in what not to do when a recall happens, which is point fingers, not accept the blame, say that maybe it might have had something to do with, you know, way you were driving your car. GM, at least in these last few months, has been sort of shouldering the blame, which it seems that customers kind of like it when you do that because they feel you're sort of standing behind the products that you're selling.
Tracy, are we seeing a recall and an increase in recalls from other companies because other guys have seen what's happened to GM and they do not want to be hauled out to NHTSA and DOT's woodshed?
Well, Sergio Marchionne, who's the CEO of Fiat Chrysler, thinks so. Last week, he said the folks who look at these recall issues and decide if they should recommend a recall or not, they're just terrified at this point that they're going to miss something the way that GM missed something.
And so I think what we're going to see is that a lot of issues will be taken up to these vehicle recall committees, some of which have nothing to do with safety.
Now, I think you can see that the automakers are very concerned about how this is going to impact consumers. But interestingly enough, Auto Trader did a recent survey just a couple weeks ago, and they found that the same number of people are less confident in that the auto industry can give them a safe car, about 44%. They've been a little shaken, their confidence, but it's the same from March, so it really isn't going anywhere.
Do we have any idea what the rate of response is when customers get these recall notices?
It's low. Sonari, have you taken a look at the numbers? I think it's like less than 60% in most cases.
It can get as high as about 75%. But then, you know, the older the car is, the less likely you are to respond. Because also, you know, the way we do recalls, we sort of send the message to the email address, that would be smart. We send it to the mailing address of the home that you had at the DMV. So what that means is if I bought a car 5 years ago and then I sold it, you know, the records may be lost. I moved to California. You still live in Ann Arbor. Mm. You know, maybe it's going to my Ann Arbor address. So, I mean, I myself recently have a pretty new car and I drove it into the dealership and they were like, oh, you got a recall. And I was like, I have been covering recalls.
And I didn't know.
I did not know that I myself had a recall on my car since September. Mm-hmm. And that is, but I think we're all going to be in that sort of, I mean, at 30 million cars, which we're likely to get to, we're all going to be in that situation really soon.
Sonari, how much of this recall action do you think has to do with the need for the automakers to have to tweak the technology that's under the hood these days?
Well, you know, when our cars are so much more complex now than they were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you think about Ford had a recall recently a few years ago, where just you needed to go and update the software. I think that the auto industry is moving towards a form that's closer to, say, your smartphone, mm-hmm. where your car gets better as you drive it and it learns more about you and figures more things out about you. And I think that consumers understand that this is not going to be an absolutely perfect product. I mean, I have a smartphone. It's had 6 updates in the 18 months that I've had it. I don't think that's a terrible smartphone, right? And I think people sort of understand that. But I think that cars are definitely more complex, especially the technology that's on the inside of the car, especially navigation systems and, you know, complex computer systems. There are dozens and dozens of computers in these cars. And I think it's a lot harder to sort of get it perfect on the first go around. Also, we know from the history of the auto industry that, you know, the first car, you know, the first line of cars that comes off, it's, you know, not going to be perfect. So you usually want to wait till the next year after they've, you know, gotten the bugs out.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with NPR's business reporter Sonari Glinton and Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton as we talk recalls, because it certainly seems like the auto industry is well on its way to breaking the recall record of nearly 31 million, and that record has stood for 10 years. Tracy, I got the sense from that bite you shared with us from Sergio Marchionne, the automakers are feeling a lot of pressure to have a perfect, perfect launch. And history has shown us, as Sonari alluded to, maybe not a reachable goal.
Yeah, well, they've got a lot of work to do on that. I know that Ford Motor Company is having weekly meetings now to try to improve the new product launches. The Escape has had 9 or 10 recalls on different models of the Escape. So they are nowhere near achieving this perfect launch. You know, part of what's going on here is in the supplier industry, especially with all these airbag recalls. Mm-hmm. A lot of the companies are using the same suppliers. So if you have one big supplier supplying parts to airbags to all the companies, you can see these sort of rolling recalls as people realize they've got the same problem as their competitor.
And that gets dicey because you have the supplier saying, well, you told us to build it that way. And the automaker going, well, you built it that way. That can lead to much finger pointing, can't it?
It can. I did want to mention my favorite recall, though, because it's every once in a while you're like, how could that have happened?
Yeah, you're dying to talk about this. Check this one, Sonari.
So, 8,200 Buick LaCrosses in Malibu's recalled because they put the rear brake rotors on the front. And I am not a car expert, okay, but I am pretty sure I would not have been able to do that because they look completely different. So I'm just boggles the mind to find out how that one happened.
Well, you know, as someone who spent his summers working in an auto plant, I can sort of imagine, you know, 800 cars is only a couple of shifts, you know.
Hey, if I buy or lease a new car, Sonari, do I assume at some point, yep, I'm going to get a recall notice?
I think so. You know, one of the things that's interesting is, you know, I have a fairly new car. It's got a recall notice. It's actually had 2 recalls on it. I think that most of us are going to increasingly, as time goes by, I mean, regardless of the sort of, you know, hypervigilance that's going on in the auto industry right now, I think as time goes on, we're going to get used to taking our car in. Another thing that I was jumping on the getting that launch perfect.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of car makers are delaying the launch of cars, which is costing a lot of money. I mean, Lincoln said, hey, we got a commercial and we got a new car. And then you're like, so where's the new car? And 7 months later, you get the feeling there was something going on in the launch of the Lincoln. I can't remember because these numbers, these letters get jumbled, the MKZ, the MKX, whichever one it was. You know, when they're taking longer to make sure that at least nothing colossal is happening when you drive the car off the lot.
And this is going to affect the profitability. Now, whether it's going to come down to us, the consumer, where we're paying extra for our cars because it's becoming more costly for the car companies to do this, or whether the investors are going to become more unhappy, it's definitely going to take a ding in profitability. Ford Motor Company just put $400 million extra in the kitty that they keep for future warranties and recalls because they're expecting to have to issue more.
So I guess I'm wondering, does this say more to us about the quality of auto building these days or the hypervigilance, as you put it so perfectly, Sonari, of the automakers? Which is it, do you think, Tracy?
You know, I think If you look at quality, we are getting better cars. There's no question that
Absolutely.
We are getting better cars than we were just 10 years ago. I think it's a combination of the hypervigilance going on here and the complexity of these vehicles.
And you get last word, Sonari.
You know, they don't make them like they used to, and thank God they don't. The cars that we drive are so much better now. Even with the recalls, Cindy, you have your cars relatively new. You got into a car just now, you'd be blown away. And it's, you know, only been a couple of years. It's so amazing all across the board how the leaps and bounds that the auto industry is going through. And I think it's an exciting time to buy a car. And so I wouldn't be scared off by a recall.
NPR business reporter Sonari Glinton and Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton. Always good talking to both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Michigan is now into year two of Right to Work. The law took effect March 2013 and made Michigan the 24th state where workers do not have to join a union as a condition of employment. Now, a lot of unions have yet to feel the impact of Right to Work because they were already under contracts or they were able to sign new agreements or extend their existing ones before the law went into effect. But Michigan's two teacher unions have indeed felt the impact of Right to Work. Doug Pratt is the Director of Member and Political Engagement for the Michigan Education Association. Thanks for talking with us today, Doug.
My pleasure.
Doug, what would you say has been the most noticeable, visible impact of Right to Work on the MEA?
You know, it forced us to pay a little bit more attention to something that we've always held dear and paid a lot of attention to, and that's making sure that we express the importance and value of membership to our members. It's not something new, but it's something that certainly has taken on a greater importance under the so-called Right to Work laws. We've always wanted to make sure that members knew what they were getting for their dues dollars and had a sense that what they were getting back was valuable to them, not just from a monetary standpoint, but also from a core value standpoint.
Doug, when you say that the MEA has been working harder to communicate with its members, what does that look like on the ground? What has been the way the members have felt this?
Well, we've tried to have more face-to-face conversations with people. That's really what is meaningful about this. I mean, we're all in education. This is about working in person with other people. So that's really been the focal point, is trying to spend more time working one-on-one with folks. I mean, certainly, you know, we do our magazine and emails and websites and Facebook and all the other things you would expect. But,
sure.
You know, it's about those conversations and about getting to the core of what are the issues involved in public education. I mean, first and foremost, we hear all the time about the impacts of Governor Snyder's cuts to public education. And what that's done in classrooms and school buildings across the state. And that energy from those conversations, that tie that binds everybody together, is something that we think is going to, you know, serve the students of this state well as we head into the elections this fall.
We're speaking with the Director of Member and Political Engagement for the Michigan Education Association, Doug Pratt, as we look back over the first year of Right to Work in Michigan. A little accounting, if we can, Doug. How many members are now in the MEA?
We have just shy of 150,000 total members across the state.
And how many members have left? I know you have that August resignation period. How many decided to not financially support the union and leave?
Last August, we had about 1,500 who chose to resign their membership.
Okay. And as we talk today, how many are in arrears with their dues?
Well, it's interesting because sometimes dues and Right to Work get linked together. There's actually a separate issue involved here that the legislature attacked only the rights of school employees by making it illegal to collect dues via payroll deduction, which is how people have paid dues forever. So we've had to spend a lot of time going around setting up systems, contacting people to get credit cards or bank information or have them send checks in to pay their dues. There are about 7,000 people who are still in some process in terms of us trying to contact them and get them signed up for an alternate method of paying their dues.
So would that be you being able to deduct from their bank accounts or their credit cards?
Or them sending in a check or going online to make a payment every month, yes. There are still a pocket of people, and we talk to people every day who just didn't know. I don't know about you, Cynthia, but it's been a while since I actually balanced my checkbook, I'll admit to your listeners. It's something that just you don't know it until you don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finding people who, are good union members and who want to belong to MEA who just didn't know that they weren't paying, and so now they're getting signed up.
Doug, do you think or do you worry that Right to Work has introduced a sense of division into schools and classrooms in Michigan with the membership?
I think it's introduced a sense of division in the entire state. I think you look at our state and our politics and our economics, and this state, especially under this governor, Governor Snyder, has become more divided. Right to Work is certainly part of that, but it's not the only thing. I think you look at the economic policies of this administration. Snyder's decision to give a massive tax giveaway to corporate CEOs and special interests and pay for it by cutting schools, taxing our seniors, increasing taxes on the middle class and the working poor, that has sown division. All of this is divisive.
I want to get your take from the MEAs, from where you sit with the MEA, about the long-term impacts of Right to Work. Say you and I are having this conversation after the five-year anniversary of this law. What do you see?
I think you see a stronger union. I think you see a union that, that has membership that believes at its core in working together for public education. I think you see an organization that continues to do what it's always done and try to put its best foot forward with its members about why membership is important. But I think you do see a stronger union on the backside of this. I think that is certainly the unintended consequence. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of energy. There's a lot of divisiveness that's shown as part of that. But we're committed, and our members are committed, to making sure that MEA continues to be here. MEA has been around for 160 years. It's going to be around for 160 more. And it's going to be a strong organization out there advocating for our students, because the working environments of school employees are the learning conditions for our kids. They are inextricably linked. And I don't think that mission's going anywhere anytime soon, regardless of the laws that this legislature and this governor have passed.
Doug Pratt is with the Michigan Education Association. Doug, thanks for spending time and talking with us today.
Absolutely.
Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary added more than 150 new words and definitions this week to get us all up to date on words like selfie, crowdfunding, hashtag, and youper. Yes, Merriam-Webster added youper, which it defined, here's the quote, as a native or resident of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan used as a nickname. Well, here's the hiccup. Merriam-Webster left off the P in its suggested pronunciation. So if you relied on that, you might say, hey, congrats on making Merriam-Webster, you lucky ewers. A Merriam-Webster rep admits, yes, they forgot the P in the pronunciation, but they tell us the rest of the entry is just fine. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Omar Sadeh, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.